Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has five causes consolidated into four oral arguments on its oral submission docket. We will complete these arguments before lunch. We'll take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument. We have allotted 20 minutes for each side to present arguments. Petitioners or relators may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. In the order in which you will hear arguments, they are Stan Frasel and Louise Herbert versus Raymond Johnson and others from Harris County, Santa Rosa Healthcare Corporation versus Linda Garcia from Hidalgo County, American Home Products Corporation and others versus the Honorable Mario Ramirez, Judge, consolidated with American Home Products Corporation and others versus the Honorable Martha Tanner, Judge, original mandamus proceeding, and Maritime Overseas Corporation versus County. Arguments are being recorded by our clerk, and you may purchase a tape of the argument by making application at the clerk's office. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Frasel versus Johnson.
May it please the court, Ms. Patricia Barron will present argument for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm honored to be here today along with trial counsel Lee Arellano, who is joining me in representing the estate of Terry Lynn Frasel and her surviving family members. This is the epilepsy failure to warn case that I'm sure you've been reading about and preparing for. Since the time is very limited, I'm going to just kind of jump real quick into the areas that I think are the most important that you might be most interested in. As you know, the Court of Appeals held that there was a duty to warn the patient a duty to third parties as to one of the doctors, but not as to two of the doctors. We believe that to the extent the duty was not extended to two of the doctors, that holding was wrong, unjust, unfair, and just not the law. The court, in making the distinction between the doctors, employed an actual knowledge test in determining foreseeability. As to the doctor who they found liable, they said that his treatment was not so unrelated to epilepsy to say that there was no duty. The dissent focused on the creation of impairment tests, the malfeasance, misfeasance, nonfeasance distinction between the Gooden and Flynn cases, and the consultation issue. As to the scope of the treatment, the doctor who was found to have a duty had actually had. What I plan to talk about is the difference between Gooden and Flynn and the various sources of duty in this case. As you know, in the Gooden case, the Tyler Court of Appeals held that a doctor could owe a duty to the public. In that case, the doctor had prescribed Quaaludes.
That's a no-writ case.
Yes, Your Honor. And in that case, there was found to be a duty. In the Flynn case, that involved a patient who had recreationally used drugs and showed up at the hospital. The doctor gave a drug with no known side effects to help the situation. And the majority there refused to impose a duty based on the misfeasance-malfeasance distinction. However, if you'll note, at the end of that opinion on rehearing, Justice Hedges has a discussion about, well, I think we made the right decision, but do you need foreseeability and a special relationship, or are these two separate things? I really don't understand. And that's the way I read it. And I believe that this court cleared that up in the Aiken case when it said that these are two separate analyses. If you have a special relationship, you don't have to get into that multi-factor Phillips versus greater transportation type analysis. And We believe that there is a duty on all three doctors under both theories, the regular Phillips analysis and the special relationship test.
Ms. Barron, how would you define this duty that you would impose upon all these doctors to third persons?
Well, Your Honor, we would not actually impose this duty on all doctors to all third persons. I believe that the unique facts of our case is that this involves an impairment that neither the physician nor the patient created. This is someone who has a physical disability.
Well, how would you have us state the duty you're asking us to recognize in this case?
Physicians who are treating a physically impaired person owe that person a duty, owe the public and that person, owe that person, and the duty is extended to a greater group, as it was in the Aiken case. Owe that person and the public a greater duty. We pled failure to warn.
What duty?
Well, you would have to look at the plaintiff's petition and what the plaintiff pleads and then determine as a court whether or not in that particular case that duty exists. In our case, we pled failure to warn the epileptic himself, a duty the doctor already has, but that duty extended to the public.
So the duty that you're asking us to impose is a duty to the public to warn physically impaired patients of their limitations? Is that what you're asking us to do?
In this particular case, yes.
This is going to be a case-by-case determination in terms of what kind of duty is owed to third parties by physicians.
It's my understanding under Greater Transport versus Phillips, that's the way we do this. We either engage in a multi-factored analysis if the actor has created the danger, or if not, we find our duty from some other source. In this case, I believe we have that duty under that analysis, and I believe we have that duty also under the special relationship test. And the physician relationship between the patient, the epileptic patient and the doctor.
Are there any limitations on this duty to that we're discussing? With respect to warning, the duty to the public to warn physically impaired patients of their limitations.
Which duty that physician already has. So I don't, when you say limitation, to me it's something that already exists.
Would you
expand
on that, please?
So I don't really understand the question.
What is your legal basis for concluding that a physician owes a duty to one of his or her patients to warn them not to drive if they are, let's say, an epileptic?
Well, based on the evidence in our case, we have affidavits. And that was what these physicians were hired to do. They were all involved in some aspect of this fellow's treatment. And what this record shows is that he actually had a seizure 10 months before the fateful accident. He received a refill of his prescription from one of the doctors who never followed up, a neurosurgeon, one who was supposedly primarily responsible. When he had this seizure, he told the first fellow was the neurologist, Waller. He told the neurosurgeon immediately when he had it. The neurosurgeon refilled, didn't get a specialist consult. He went to a family practitioner the week before the accident who took a Dilantin level and said to the fellow, your levels are within normal range.
If I could, let me redirect you to where I'm going. What legal authority do you have to support the proposition that a doctor has to warn an epileptic not to drive? Do you have any case authority or other type of legal authority saying that such a duty exists?
Well, the Gooden case says that a doctor owes the patient a duty in diagnosis and treatment to fulfill that duty.
To fulfill which duty? Not to warn, not to drive.
Well, you go and you look at the duty the plaintiff is alleging, you analyze it under the Phillips test, foreseeability, likelihood of injury, risk of harm versus social utility.
I understand. The general principles is what you're arguing. I guess what I'm trying to find out is, are you aware of any specific legal authority saying that doctors owe a duty to their patients to inform them not to drive if their physical condition is such that it may impair their driving?
I believe that Gooden says that because when you go back and look, it talks about physical condition because of medication or physical condition. But there are two cases, in fact, from other jurisdictions that impose that duty based on a special relationship. What they do is they take the tariff off duty, which was extended to third parties based on a patient's condition, and they expand it. They use the analogy of someone with a dangerous propensity, and that there's a relationship and that a duty is owed. One of those cases I cited in my reply, Duval versus Golden, that case involved a psychiatrist and an epileptic patient. There's another case that isn't cited in my reply called Myers. The site is 144 Cal App 3rd 888, and that was a failure to warn a diabetic who didn't have the condition under control. So those two cases, I believe, are strong authority under the special relationship principle.
Ms. Brown, let me ask you, is there a need for this duty? Would not the patient who has an automobile accident and figures that the cause of that accident was that they weren't warned not to drive when they were given some medicine, couldn't they sue their own doctor for having failed to warn them of a side effect that caused them damage? Is there any need to create another duty on the part of the doctor to skip the patient who, in fact, is the one complaining of the breach of the duty?
No, the patient isn't complaining. We're the people who the patient killed. And
you did not sue the person that caused the accident?
There was a settlement with the person who caused the accident. This is the suit between the people who were injured by the epileptic patient.
Well, that was, going back to my point, the need for this duty. You're arguing for a duty of a patient, duty of a doctor to people that the doctor's patient injures because of some conduct of the patient. You're arguing that the conduct of the patient, although contributing, was really the result of some failure of the doctor to warn the patient about the patient's condition. If the patient believes that they were not the cause of this wreck, the patient could certainly sue their own doctor for this failure to warn, could they not?
Right. How does that help the person who was killed?
The question is, the person who was killed has their cause of action against the person that killed them. Where is the need for the person who was killed to have an additional duty against the doctor? That if the driver says, well, the doctor caused it, the driver could sue their own doctor and claim that that doctor ought to be paying for the damages that result from this accident. Is there any need to go further down the stream of responsibility here and have a separate cause of action by the injured person, skipping the one who caused the injury? I guess I'm trying to evaluate if there's a real need for this.
It seems to me that you're deciding causation from the plaintiff's perspective in this case, it wasn't the patient. It was the doctor. That's the plaintiff's perspective in this case. And that we are going directly to the person who is responsible. And in terms of the policy
arguably the patient caused the accident. The question is, was the patient negligent or not negligent as a result of some condition that was contributed to a doctor? Isn't that what the...
Well, we don't believe that that's true in the case of this disability. We believe that the primary responsibility is with the physician in this case. You know, one of the things that we discussed was the waiver of the doctor-patient privilege in the area of driver's licenses, and that this evinces to us some type of concern the legislature has with people being on the road. So the duty, because of statutes surrounding the area, to us seems also to be a public duty. I mean, I guess it would be the same reason you expanded and broadened the duty, or the rest of the court did in the Aiken case, to not just the little individual boy who suffered that horrible situation, but to everyone at that church and all the parents. This person was in the zone of danger, I guess. It could have been anyone.
Let's go. Let's take this one step further. Let's assume that there is some sort of duty that skips the patient, that the injured person goes against the patient's doctor. This is a failure to warn issue you're arguing about. Well, simply the doctor was satisfied the duty by warning. But
and monitoring and assessing. There's also an issue of that raised in the affidavit.
Well, let's go further. So I have a patient that I'm treating for epilepsy. Is my duty to order the patient not to drive, or is my duty to simply warn the patient that you can have an accident if you drive, but I don't take steps to stop the patient from driving?
I guess the duty is, if the patient shows up in your office a week before they have a horrible accident and they've recently had a seizure, and you take a blood level, while you're taking the blood level, to say, by the way, have you had any seizures since you visited me last a year ago? We have affidavit testimony attached to our response to the summary judgment to that effect. In fact, one of the defendant doctors, in his deposition, part of which is attached to one of our responses, says, you know, there's a dispute about whether he warned. He claims he did, and he claimed it was his duty, like any other doctors, to do so.
So this is
out of the mouths of their own.
So the doctor would have a duty to keep an epileptic from driving?
No, not to control, to warn.
If a doctor does give a warning to an epileptic not to drive, the doctor has, at that point in time, discharged his or her duty. And if the epileptic goes out and has an accident, then the doctor arguably would be entitled to summary judgment on the basis that he or she fulfilled their duty.
Your Honor, I think if there's a duty, we go back and we have a trial on that issue. And if the jury determines that the doctor fulfilled the duty, they'll tell the plaintiff to go home.
And the fulfillment of the duty would be merely informing the epileptic not to drive.
Yes, a duty that already exists. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Ms. Marie McCullough and Ms. Kenneth Snelling will present argument for the respondents. Ms. McCullough will open argument with the first argument.
May it please the court, my name is Kareem McCullough. I represent Dr. Johnson, a family physician, Dr. Waller, a neurologist, and Sadler Clinic, where the physicians practiced. Under the facts surrounding this accident caused by Ronald Peterson, does this court want to recognize the duty appraisals argue for against these doctors? The court is exactly right. Several of us have asked the question, what is the duty? If you look at the briefing, you find that it's a duty to warn, a duty to inquire, a duty to document. If the patient says yes, do we then have a duty to take the car keys away? What are the parameters of this duty?
Let's assume for a second that the parameter of the duty is merely one to warn an epileptic not to drive. Is that an onerous burden to place upon a physician?
It would not be an onerous burden place on a physician if the facts indicated that that was what was required. The facts of this case do not indicate that, Your Honor. The undisputed facts are that we have a lifelong epileptic, Peterson, who had a lengthy relationship with Dr. Johnson and Dr. Waller, who had informed both physicians on previous occasions of his seizure activity, who had sought treatment for his seizure activity, who had been compliant with his medication therapy, had called for refills for his prescriptions, who was stable with his seizures, whose current Dilantin levels just 7 days before the accident were within the therapeutic range, and who had had no seizures to this doctor's knowledge on the date of the accident within 4 years. The other doctor had not seen the patient for over 18 months. At that point, he had been seizure-free for over 3 years. There were no indications, no facts to say warn, unless you want to impose a duty every time a physician sees a patient with a medical condition to warn and document that you've warned so that the duty is fulfilled. If negligence rests primarily on the existence of a reason to anticipate injury and the failure to perform the duty arising out of that anticipation, on the facts here, we do not believe that a duty exists. It was not foreseeable that Peterson, seeking treatment for the flu, who had sought treatment for epilepsy in the past, would not also tell the doctor of that he had recent seizure activity. Common sense tells you, whether the record is clear or not, whether the record is documented that he asked or didn't ask, common sense tells you when the patient presented with symptoms, the questions would have been asked, how are you doing? The very fact that he pulled the serum dilantin level indicates the seizures must have been discussed or the condition must have been discussed because we're documenting the anticonvulsant drug in the man's system. Did he act reasonably under those facts? We believe that he did. There is no reason to create a duty. We believe that the Court of Appeal acted appropriately and affirmed the summary judgment. We ask that the court do that also.
Are there any circumstances under which a physician owes a duty to third parties arising out of his treatment of a patient?
If he treated him negligently, if he created the condition which led to the third party's injury, then perhaps that duty would be there. In this instance, however, he did not create. The treatment that they were using was successful. The seizures had been.
So you would recognize a duty under some circumstances?
There could be a duty under some circumstances. There are some cases that say that, where you have created the duty, the misfeasance cases, or where you have done something that actively creates the issue or the problem. In this instance, that did not happen. The duty was not there. Summary judgment was appropriate. The Court of Appeals appropriately affirmed.
Let me jump on the slippery slope. If I understand you correctly, you're saying that because the last time this doctor knew about any type of epileptic problem was 18 months ago, the doctor should not be held to a duty to inform the patient not to drive.
At that point, he had released Peterson to go back to work and to drive, because he had been seizure-free 3 years before. So he was not, under the facts of this case, he had not been driving because we released him from that stair. So the accident in 91 to be imputed back to the negligence or to the doctor's conduct in 89 seems a bit of a stretch. If there are no further questions, Your Honors, we urge the court to affirm.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, may it please the court. My name is Tina Snelling. I represent Dr. Windenburg, and I'm here today, and we're all here today, to discuss the topic whether a tortfeasor's doctor should be perfect, because we're going to skip the auto policy and go to the doctor's malpractice policy. And that's what this case is about. So you've been absolutely right, Your Honors, in that line of questioning. I could name a line of cases to this court that has shown this court's reluctance to expand a duty to third persons. In the recent years, we've seen the Seagram's case that says alcohol manufacturers don't have a duty to warn of the obvious problems associated with alcohol. We have the Watson case where a third party does not have the standing to sue a tortfeasor's auto insurer.
Is it your position there's no duty at all or just no duty under the facts?
No, but I think we get down the slippery slope when we start trying to have a court fashion what is a duty and what is the standard of care in medical malpractice world that we're going to fashion a test to give a remedy for third parties. Remember, we've got 4590I here, which is the legislature found that there was a problem in a health care crisis, that they came up with this reform to provide a mechanism for relief for patients of doctors who had committed malpractice, but at the same time, put some safety mechanisms in there, like a review panel now.
What would the duty be to two third parties? Is there any at all? What is it?
I can't say that there would never be a duty because I think Parasol would probably be a good starting point. This court has had a couple of encounters with the Parasol rule, and we know that that says that when there's a psychiatrist, who's obviously a physician, has got an uncontrollable patient on their hand, And that patient has expressed the comments that they want to kill or hurt a readily identifiable victim, then obviously there's a duty to control that person or to warn that readily identifiable victim's family. You see the problem here, Your Honor. We don't have a readily identifiable victim. If you go past Tarasoff, which incidentally
Let's assume the facts were a little different, that the patient had been told not to drive, was in fact not driving, and the doctor was negligent in releasing them to drive. Would that you owe a duty to third parties under those circumstances?
I don't think that's the problem I have, Your Honor, with trying to get this duty to drive or not to drive and release.
The patient is relying on the physician and says, Doctor, I haven't been driving and I won't drive if you tell me not to drive. If you tell me I'm okay to drive, I will. And the doctor negligently
The patient obviously has a lawsuit against the doctor under 4590.
What about the third party?
About the third party? I haven't seen anything that would indicate that we should go beyond Tarasoff at a minimum.
How's that different?
Because you have a patient who, for one thing, let's go straight to the duty. What are the problems with defining the parameters you shouldn't drive? Is it you shouldn't drive or you can't drive? Because you know what's happened to Dr. Windenburg in this case? There was absolutely no controversy that Dr. Windenburg said, I warned them not to drive. In his deposition, he said, I told them they shouldn't drive. Do you know what their controverting affidavits say? I was told I could not drive. So now we're getting into semantics. Is it should not drive or could not drive? The Court of Appeals said that Dr. Windenburg, there was a fact issue because he never told them they should not drive. That is not true. That was never controverted. That's game, set, and match.
Back to the duty.
Distinguish yes.
Tarasoff, if you
can. Tarasoff, readily identifiable victim. The Thompson case, which was later came down after Tarasoff, had to do with a psychiatrist who was trying to be held accountable by the plaintiff for a child who was attacked in the neighborhood. They said, no, it's not enough that your patient decided that he was, or said he was going to attack some child in some neighborhood. That's too broad. We're not going to expand the duty that far. If you take the reasoning of the Thompson and the Tarasoff cases, what you've got here is you're imposing a generalized duty on a doctor to protect the driving public at large. I don't think Texas is ready to go that far yet.
What if you have a situation where the doctor is seeing someone who is undergoing an epileptic seizure, and the doctor says, here, take two aspirin and go home. The patient says, I'm driving. The doctor says, well, drive carefully. And so it's fairly deducible that epileptic is going to have a car wreck on the way home. Is the court supposed to turn a blind eye to that type of conduct, or are we to establish a duty in that situation?
You know, this court has said that it's more than foreseeability. It's also the opportunity to control. That's what the Gooden versus Tips case was about.
No, I disagree that a doctor has the right to control whether or not someone walks out of their doctor's office.
You're absolutely right.
And so you're saying since the doctor doesn't have the right to control the patient walking out of the office, a doctor who knows in likelihood that someone is going to have a seizure while they're driving home has no duty to either that party or to the world at large knowing that that person is about to get in a car wreck.
I think that you're changing the factual scenario a little bit, Your Honor.
I am.
Where
I
don't know if the grand mal seizure is imminent when that man is about to walk out the door. I don't know if, within those parameters, how long it takes a controlling medication that could control the possibility of that grand mal seizure from occurring. But if you're saying just on that set of facts, that it's going to happen when he walks out that door, I'd say let's address that for another day. That's certainly a good question, but it's not evident in this case.
Do you think the Gooden case is wrong?
Pardon, sir?
Is Gooden versus Tips wrong?
Do I think Gooden versus Tips is wrong? No, I can't say that Gooden versus Tips is wrong. I can't say that it applies in this case.
That really wasn't my question. But, I mean, you're making an argument about never any duty to third person, so I'm asking.
I would concede that if there were a duty, that we, under Gooden versus Tips, if you give a patient a mind-altering drug and you send them on the road, and it has changed their functioning and impaired their functioning, something that you've given them, you've controlled the dispensation, then yes, you could be subject to liability. But on the converse, we've got a gentleman who's 42 years old. We'd have to go back in time to his very first physician when he was diagnosed at 9 to see if that doctor warned him that when he gets to driving age, that he better watch it and not drive if he has a seizure, to all the subsequent doctors, to Drs. Johnson and Waller, and to Dr. Windenberg, who's a neurosurgeon who operated only on his back, and we've imposed a duty on him now to treat an epileptic man and make him responsible for the epileptic diagnosis and treatment. The Lopez case cited in my brief, you know, sets out that just because an epileptic patient tells a back doctor that when they're about to go into surgery that, by the way, I'm an epileptic, and that's considered, that is not a diagnosis. And that's what happened here. He told Dr. Windenberg in April 90, months and months and months and months before January 1991, the date of the wreck. The other thing that's not been mentioned here is it's undisputed that Ronald Peterson, the driver, was being treated for many years by Drs. Johnson and Waller for his epilepsy. He was still being treated. And at the time that he told Dr. Windenberg, Dr. Windenberg was his back doctor. When he told Dr. Windenberg, Dr. Windenberg said, you need to see your treating physicians about this. So here we go. It's a mess. It's
was
a mess.
Was it Dr. Windenberg who provided the affidavit that said that he thought that there was a duty to inform the patient not to drive?
No, Dr. Windenberg said that he asked all of his patients to tell him if they have a debilitating condition, such as epilepsy, and that is his recommendation to tell them that. And that's not been disputed, Your Honor.
And did he say that was the reasonable standard of care?
That was his opinion. I don't think anyone asked him if that was the reasonable standard of care across the board, or if that was the reasonable standard of care for treating physicians who are treating an epilepsy patient. I think his affidavit was in the standard of care as a neurosurgeon who performed back surgery and established a friendly client, a patient-doctor relationship with his client, patient. Anyway, Your Honors, we've got a problem. If you wanted to go that far to expand the duty beyond Tarasoff to the public at large, is the warning enough to say, should have, you should not drive, or do you say, you cannot drive? Does it have to be oral? Does it have to be written? The Court of Appeals seems to suggest if it's not in the medical record, then it's no good. It's no good. You've got to have a cannot drive, should not drive in writing. Do you have to have witnesses? What if the tortfeasor later says, well, I didn't appreciate what they were telling me, the significance of it. I mean, we could just have all kinds of battles. This court in Smith-Kline had a case that they dealt with very similar to this. I would say very similar. Smith-Kline was a lab that did urine testings for prospective job candidates. That job candidate didn't get the job because Smith-Kline determined that there were opium traces. Turned out she ate poppy seeds on a muffin. And she sued Smith-Kline for failure to warn. They should have warned her that there have been other kinds of possibilities to cause false readings. And this court said, no, not going to do it, because there's these too many possibilities of all kinds of things that could cause false results. Putting that duty would be too broad on Smith-Kline, the lab testing people. And here we've got a back doctor who's being held to the standard of the treating physician, and he's being given told to provide a duty to warn. Is it written? Is it oral? Is it should have? Is it can't do? Don't know. And then the court next said that it wasn't going to extend the duty on Smith-Kline to warn when that could be done with the prospective and candidates and the employer. The employer could tell them those possibilities. It also had the impact of impinging on other professionals who are rendering service as part of that lab treating process. Well, if you take that to its logical extreme, we could get the pharmacist in here for filling the prescription if it was the friendly Eckerd neighborhood store who knew Mr. Peterson. We could get the lab testing technicians. How far do we take the duty? How far do we take it to Tarasov? How far should we really be considering this case and putting a duty on a back doctor who, yeah, he concededly, he refilled the prescription for his client, for his patient, Dr. Peterson. He did it gratuitously. And he did that in June of 1990. And you know what? Mr. Peterson went back to his treating physicians 1 week before the accident. And that's nothing, no proximate cause of refilling that prescription because Mr. Peterson's blood levels were fine. So what has my client done? Absolutely nothing. This is not the case to expand the duty, Your Honors, and it certainly isn't one to expand the duty to protect third parties against the patient in this instance. Dr. Winberg.
Any other questions? Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'd like to start out by asking you to please read those Myers and Duvall cases that I cited to you. They'll say more to you than I can in this short 5 minutes. In terms of Ms. Snelling's point about a readily identifiable patient, the reason you need that in that situation where you're warning a third party is obviously you can't tell a psychotic patient, by the way, don't kill your wife. That's the reason you need a readily identifiable person, and that's the distinction in our case. That is discussed in one of those two cases that I cited to you. This case is perhaps one of the most important because we're dealing with what I call a time bomb patient. Contrary to this being obvious, we have someone who has a disability who thinks it's under control. And the only way he can find out about this situation is from the very professionals who claim that they have absolutely no responsibility. This cannot be. When I was sitting at counsel table, I thought I was in a trial court. This is a summary judgment case. And by the way, the facts really are hotly controverted. Obviously, I piqued your interest enough for you to have us come here, but you know, you read these things over and over again, and I noticed even more controverting facts. In 83, the patient went to see the family practitioner and reported history of seizures and that he would be on, and the practitioner decided he'd be on medication indefinitely. In 85 and 86, he showed up again in May of 85 with a seizure he had had the day before. At that point, he was referred to the neurologist, Waller. They couldn't get it under control.
There was some mention in the briefs about a driver's license. That Mr. Peterson had a driver's license.
That's not in the...
It's not in the record.
No. And
is there some way that the a driver receives a driver's license if they're impaired in some way? Is that made known to the state that they're only to drive with glasses or when they're taking their medicine? How does that work?
My understanding, that is not an issue in this case. My understanding briefly is that the doctor can voluntarily give that information and not be subject to a suit from the patient for breach of privilege, or the patient can volunteer that information when he renews, if he renews or reapplies.
There's no form that you fill out that...
I don't believe that's in the record. Anyway, as I was saying, there were two seizures, one in May of 86 and one in June of 86. Yet you read these doctor's affidavits and they say the seizure in June of 86 was the first seizure. Look at it, one of the exhibits attached to Peterson's affidavit. It wasn't the first seizure. The first seizure was the month before. Look at, I believe it's Johnson's answers to interrogatories. There were two seizures that happened in 86. Waller tried to get the seizures under control, the medication under control, could not do it. 89 patients stopped seeing both of them. But Waller refills the seizure medication in May of 90, and 1 month later, Peterson has a seizure, and Waller doesn't know about it. He's a neurosurgeon. He's a specialist. Why doesn't he know about it? Waller says he had told Peterson to tell his doctor if he had a seizure. In fact, Peterson did tell Dr. Wendenberg, who he was going to. Dr. Wendenberg, knowing Peterson had had a seizure,
refilled the prescription without consulting a specialist who he claims was responsible. And if you had the deposition testimony before you, which is not in record, wasn't part of the summary judgment evidence, you would see that the doctor knew, he claimed that they were responsible, and that he got his instructions on how to refill it from the patient.
Ms. Barron, is your claim an assertion that the doctors committed medical malpractice?
No.
It's your claim there was some sort of product defect because they failed to warn.
We're claiming that there was a foreseeable harm, that they had a responsibility, and that they breached that responsibility both to the patient, but in this case, we're not representing the patient, we're representing the person who was injured. My mere purpose in trying to get through these facts is to show you that there are some very hotly controverted issues. And by the way, when Dr.
Excuse me, I think you're past the scope of
Thank you.
Judge Enos' question.
Are there other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will take a brief recess.